7. I've been waiting for this interview, I can tell you, for a while. Case number 34502 of 2010 in the North Gauteng High Court could potentially stand in the way of David Mabuza becoming the next South African president. Since July 2010, conservationist Fred Daniel has been fighting back after losing his 39,000 hectare nature reserve, which he argues was brought about by a run-in with corrupt Mpumalanga politicians. He's faced vandalism, arson, smears, death threats, which he says have all brought him to ruin. He's now suing for 1 billion rand, and that trial has been consistently delayed, going on 12 years now. Will he finally get justice? He joins us now on the line. Fred, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with us this morning. Given, of course, that this is still a matter before the courts, I understand that you may be limited in terms of what you can say, but nonetheless, I appreciate you joining us.
Morning, Bongani, and thank you for inviting me. It's a beautiful morning today.
Well, I hope it will turn out to be a beautiful one in terms of the case proceeding. But perhaps let's go back a little. Your matter is a well-publicized one. The allegations you make are even covered in that excellent book by Rihanna Rousseau. Is it a surprise to you that so few South Africans seem to know about it?
Yes, you know, books in South Africa don't sell that much as what they do normally. So books have a limited exposure. It's just important to know that I never wrote the book. It was done by independent journalist Rihanna Rousseau, and she interviewed me and I gave her information, and it was published by Jacana. So we didn't have any financial interest in the book.
Oh, yeah, of course.
The last thing I want to do is preempt a court case or influence a court case. So it was written independently, and it did get part of the story out there.
All right, let's talk about then your situation. Your nightmare began with your acquisition of this nature reserve. How did that come about?
Well, it was after a 7-year search, and I'm very aware of the ecosystem collapse. You know, the biodiversity is a very, very important aspect of keeping the biosphere going. Not many people understand the link between biodiversity and the biosphere. And this is the last decade that the UN have said that we can actually reverse environmental degradation. So it was a challenge for me to find a project to combat biodiversity decline and also climate change. And the idea was to do it on a scalable basis and educational as well. And it was just my effort to contribute, to do something positive to the breakdown of nature. And so we searched for this specific project for 7 years, and I happened to come into that area by chance, having found what I was looking for in that area between Butcross and Barberton.
So you were going to start what, this ecological project? You wanted to create employment. It was potentially going to attract tourists and also become some kind of educational center. Tell us exactly the plan that you had in mind, and what did it cost you to get going?
Well, conservation projects are very expensive, and they're very long term, which also explains why you couldn't just give up and go away. You know, once you've committed yourself to a project like that, it's a lifetime. And the educational aspect is critical to the project, and of course the scientific aspect to run the project on scientific terms. So we had a lot of scientists involved, and it's multifunctional. You've got lots of specific aspects. But the most important part is to protect and repair nature. The place we found was very special, and it's one of the highest biodiversity areas in the world. But when we found it, many of the animals had gone extinct, and some of the plants, and there was a lot of damage. So we had the extra burden of not just protecting the biodiversity, we had to actually repair the landscapes, and we had to rehabilitate the landscapes, and we had to make it sustainable financially and ecologically, where we had to introduce keystone species that actually help the environment. Like the lion is a keystone species. Many people don't understand that, or elephant is a flagship species. So they're necessary for ecological purposes and for financial sustainability. But basically, it's all about protecting and repairing the environment, and we had the extra burden of bringing in animals that used to be there not so long ago, that were hunted to extinction, and they were very necessary to build tourism. And the whole project, I mean, the purpose of the project is also to create quality employment for people. What? Otherwise, it's not sustainable, and it doesn't work for the local communities.
What did it cost you, Fred?
Well, in the end, with my partners, about 2010, we'd already invested $500 million into the project.
I mean, you go into some detail about what you used in terms of information to tell you about how those ecosystems worked, even looking at rock art, ancient rock art, to tell you the animals that would have been natural to that environment, bringing in species to make sure that, for example, predator species were there to deal with, sick animals, and just make sure that that whole system was working. When did things begin to go all right?
Actually, the day I opened the project in April 1999, we came into conflict with some of the officials because we needed tools like adequate enclosure certificates, and we didn't know that that some of these things had been repurposed, and the beneficial use of certain processes were being exploited by civil servants. So right from the beginning, I felt there was something wrong. And I spent most of the time trying to find out where the conflicts lie and why there were these conflicts and why there was this hostility. Because at the end, the project was perfectly aligned with government planning studies, was perfectly aligned with the mandate of the Parks Board and the Land Claims Commission, because the key element was land rich in biodiversity. The land was the responsibility of the Department of Agriculture and the Land Claims Commissioner, and the biodiversity part was the responsibility of the Parks Board. And trying to get service delivery to be able to run this place lawfully, that was where the problems came in. The conflict arose at the nexus of service delivery, where certain civil servants were mixing politics, business, criminality, and it took me all the time. I only really worked out what was going on by 2017 when that book Shadow State came out, and when the words repurposing and state capture were starting to be defined by scientists, specifically Professor Schwilling and Professor Chipkin and those people. Then I started understanding that, and then I also understood that in South Africa, politicians use lawlessness in order to achieve a goal.
Fred,
unfortunately, a problem.
I have to come in here. Just go back to the problems you started encountering. You may have connected the dots later on, but initially, as you say, you had these problems around permits and the like, but also then you were hit with a land claim, which you believe was a scam.
Yes, well, Richard Spur, we approached him because he's a world-famous human rights attorney. And we asked him, one of the things that I was very sensitive about when I searched for land, and I went everywhere in Southern Africa, it took me 7 years, is during since 1992 and 98, obviously one is very sensitive about land claims, and we didn't want to get into an area where there was any notion of land claims. Although there are valid land claims in Buttplaas, they really land labor tenant claims because of the incredible history of the place, with the Swazis and how the fur trickers arrived there, and the transactions they did, and the way they cooperated, and the transfer of skills. But in the end, these labor tenant claims were turned into fraudulent land restitution claims in order to grab, basically land grab.
Just explain how you believe the land claim against your land in particular was a scam.
Well, it's very simple. We put a fire application on them for information. Richard Spur begged and pleaded year in and year out for information. They wanted to know who the beneficiaries are, what the history was, because the Land Restitution Act makes it unlawful to admit to a fraudulent land claim. And we on record saying that we will be delighted to work with the communities. If there is a valid land claim, we would cooperate. With the, Section 11 of the Restitution Act requires mediation. I think it's mandatory. So we were very much prepared to submit ourselves to mediation even, but we just got no response. They just ignored us. It was very embarrassing. And we were desperate to get information. And had they, the turning point came in 2007 when we brought an application to compel them. And that's when they ducked that and found a way not to disclose information. Everything would have been resolved had they just disclosed the information to us. But then they started to take the law into their own hands, and we started seeing a parallel process running to push us off the land.
So how did David Mabuza get involved? What role did he play?
Well, he decided to get involved in Buttplast because, as I said, that so-called land claim was parked in the land claims court deliberately, and it wasn't going anywhere, and they made all these promises. So somebody had to come in and deal with me, and there was a committee set up, and the committee started cutting fences. The committee went on Radio Alpha and said they were going to kill us and chase us away. He phoned me one day and he told me that I had to admit this land claim, otherwise he couldn't protect my life. He couldn't protect the property. And I was horrified because, the advice of Sol Kersner and the Development Bank, and later the rule of Dubai, all these people who were involved in the project, and of course Richard Spur, was that you cannot admit to this land claim because everything told us that these land claims were fake. They were fake beneficiaries. The history was fake. And so he arrived one day when they hit. They tried to bomb the petrol station, and the police refused. The police told us that they were instructed not to come and help us. And it was on a Saturday, on the 2nd of August, 2008, when a crowd of people bust in from Middelburg. They weren't even land claimants, and they started burning tires, and they cut fences in broad daylight, and they smashed windows, and there were tourist buses there. They smashed the tourist buses. They held up everything for hours, and the damage was worldwide because tourists saw this. It was so brutal. My staff was assaulted. They tried to bomb our fuel station. They tried to do a citizen arrest. And, it's something that I'll never forget in my life. And, Mr. Mabuza arrived there about 11 o'clock with the police. The police followed him. And he addressed the crowd in Swazi. And what he seemed to have told the crowd is that they can now stop rioting and deal, ensure that they get their land back. And then the crowd just stopped. They looked like they were waiting for him because the whole morning, and the only people that stood between, I couldn't get involved because I didn't want to be in a situation where, I was compelled to protect the place, and I would have been prepared to do it. But I'd rather, the communities came. People came with shotguns, and they stood between us and the rioters. And these people were very aggressive. And as I said, when one of my staff tried to take a photograph, they slapped him, kicked him on the ground, they took his camera away. And they were just cutting these fences, these very expensive fences that cost 150,000 a kilometer. And they didn't have any respect for the animals that were protected there in this, what is our World Heritage Site. And there was another incident where we asked for a meeting with these rioters. It's called the Great Buttplast Land Claims Committee. And they said, look, we have to go back to the committee, and an Honorable Didi Mabuza is the chairman. And that's why he called me, because when we didn't give in on that riot, because the very next day, the Sunday, I got a visit from somebody from Nelspruit, a contractor, and he said to me, why haven't you run away? We were convinced that the brutal raids, and he's just driving past and he wanted to come and see me. And I was quite shocked, and I realized he was deployed. And I said to him, what do you expect me to do? I've invested everything into this project. It's a lifetime project. It's going to take a long time. I can't just, because some unlawful people riot, be driven away and run away. So there was an expectation that I'd pack up and run that early already.
But gosh, then Fred.
When he phoned me, I said to him, I can't meet with you unless I first want to meet with you and tell you what's happened. But then John Allen and Richard Poor went to the meeting. And of course, he was sitting there as the chairman of this meeting. And when John Allen walked into the meeting, he was assaulted physically in front of Mr. Mabuza. And the guy was laughing. And, John Allen had to flee for his life and had to call security companies. It happened at the Aventura Resort. And these things were very traumatic for us.
I can imagine, Fred, you invested a lot of your money in this whole venture, and it's obviously all gone pear-shaped. But this matter will finally now be heard, and it's got to be heard virtually because, among other reasons, there have been concerns about your personal safety and that of your legal team. 12 years later, this case is finally going to be heard, and a lot of these allegations are going to be tested. I appreciate your time coming onto the show and telling us your story. If you really wanted to get a grip on it, you can read Predator Politics by Rihanna Rousseau. It's an incredible story of the loss of this 39,000 hectare nature reserve. And it gives you a sense of the years of lawlessness where Mpumalanga really was the wild, wild east.